Sen's book of baby and child care went on to sell more than 50 million copies in 39 languages, placing it among the best-selling books of all time. By the 1950s, Dr. Spock had become the modern world's clear authority on child care and development, and his views on a great variety of issues, including sleep training for infants, commanded the attention of countless doctors and parents. In 2000, the chairwoman of the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission was using her office to advise all parents to avoid sleeping with children under the age of 2. And she did so with the full support of Dr. Spock's successors, sleep scientists and child psychologists whose views on the value of individuating sleeping infants could be extreme. In the 1986 bestseller, Solve Your Child's Sleep Problems, for instance, Richard Ferber reports, "We know for a fact that people sleep better alone in bed. Parents," he acknowledges, "may be tempted to give in to their infants' desires to be near them when they slumber, and some may even feel this is in their children's best interests. But he believes they are mistaken. Sleeping alone is an important part of his learning to be able to separate from you without anxiety and to see himself as an independent individual." Ferber has tough words for parents who resist his advice. "If you find that you prefer to have your child in your bed, you should examine your own feelings very carefully, since it's possible that, instead of helping your child, you are using him to avoid facing and solving your own problems. If these problems cannot be simply settled, then professional counseling may be required." Some parents were indeed put off by the harshness of the Ferber method, but millions of others bought his books and steeled themselves for the experience of Ferberizing their children. In the process, they helped acculturate the next generation to the experience of being alone. After growing up in a private bedroom with plenty of personal time, an increasing number of young adults want to maintain the condition when they leave home for the first time, even, or perhaps especially, if they are going to college. Housing officers at universities throughout the country report that a great majority of their entering students have never shared a bedroom, and that many have trouble adjusting to life with a roommate during their first year. Once that year is finished, they're willing to pay extra to restore their privacy. On today's university campuses, the newest dormitories have an ample supply of single rooms, as well as suite-style units where students share a common area, but have a private room with a bed and desk. Most colleges developed their housing stock before students began requesting singles, however, and today demand for private sleeping quarters far exceeds the supply. For example, in 2006, Miami University Housing Director Lucinda Coveney acknowledged that the school had been consistently unable to accommodate most requests for single residences and announced plans to build hundreds of new single-room units. "We need to meet the needs of the modern student," she told the school paper. "A lot of students want that environment and privacy. We understand these residence halls were built a long time ago, and we're working to try to make on-campus living more attractive." In 2008, George Washington University reported that it had received 286 applications for 5 single-room units in one of its dorms, and promised that it would add 300 single units to its supply when it completed construction and renovation of new facilities. In 2009, Boston University opened a high-rise with luxurious apartment-style dorms for undergraduates, featuring a large number of one-person units, called singles, and suites in which each resident has a private room. In previous eras, graduating seniors packed into communal houses to share their final year of college near close friends. Today, a new spirit is emerging. "I applied by myself because my friends were all too cheap to live here," a resident of the BU dorm told the Boston Globe. Now she could live without them, too. At least one mother with a child in BU's luxury dorm recognized that her son would have a hard time maintaining his lifestyle after he left the university. You graduate facing a terrible job market and having to live with rats in Brooklyn, she told him in the fall of 2009. She could have added one more thing. Regardless of their preferences, all but the most affluent young adults who move to big cities to make it on their own soon discover that they'll also have to live with roommates. And this is significant because the distinction between living with roommates and having a home of one's own has acquired great cultural significance. For the current generation of young people, it's the crucial turning point between second adolescence and becoming adult. Take Justin, who was an aspiring journalist with a fresh degree from a Big Ten school when he got recruited to work in New York City at a job that came with transitional corporate housing. Note, Justin is a pseudonym, as are the names of all the singletons who appear in this book, except those who are public figures. Granting anonymity to the subjects of social science research is the standard way of protecting them, and universities typically require scholars to do so. On first glance, Justin appears shy and guarded. He's physically slight, with curly brown hair, deep-set eyes, and a soft, gentle voice that's often hard to hear. He's personable and funny once he gets comfortable, but since this can take a while, he found that meeting people in New York was more difficult than he'd anticipated. Living alone didn't help. Fortunately, several of his college friends had also moved there, and through them he found a shared apartment where the roommates enjoyed going out together just as they had when they were in school. Justin hadn't soured on going solo, but he knew he wasn't ready and that he could try again when the time was right. It can be fun to have roommates when you're young and single, as anyone who's watched Friends or Three's Company surely knows. Roommates provide companionship, so you don't have to feel alone when you wake up in the morning or come home after a rough day. When you move to a new city, they can help you meet people, invite you to parties, and add to your social network. They may share in the cooking, cleaning, and shopping, which means you don't have to do everything. And they help pay the rent, which means you can live in a better neighborhood or save money for going out. For years, Justin enjoyed all these benefits, so much that he endured a seemingly endless series of transitions, people moving in and out, being forced to search for new apartments, relocating to different neighborhoods, so that he could keep sharing a place with people his age. But after 5 years, Justin found himself focusing on the costs of this situation. For, as anyone who's watched Friends or Three's Company also knows, often, too often, having roommates is no fun at all. Is there anyone who has lived with roommates and not escaped with tales of woe? Review among the many stories cataloged in the Trouble with Roommates findings from my research. The roommate, once a friend, who stops paying his rent or his share of the bills. The roommate who steals. The roommate with bad taste. The roommate who never leaves home. The roommate who goes silent. The roommate who blogs about you. The roommate with the TV addiction. The roommate with a drinking problem. The roommate who eats your food. The roommate who won't do the dishes. The roommate who smells. The roommate who hates your girlfriend. The roommate who hits on your girlfriend. The roommate who becomes your girlfriend and then breaks up with you and refuses to move out. Justin's experiences were hardly catastrophic, but he had his share of difficulties. In one apartment, he and a roommate got on each other's nerves, and the atmosphere quickly became stressful. Justin dreaded seeing him in the living room or at the table. He started avoiding home or rushed straight to his room when he got there. It was awful, he remembers. When you don't feel close to your roommates, in some ways that's lonelier than living alone, because your isolation is strikingly in front of you. It totally sucks. So he moved, again to a place with roommates. The new place was better, but Justin felt himself still longing for more privacy. With roommates, he explains, when you bring a girl home, not only will the girl notice your roommates, but your roommates will notice her. The social life at home becomes a burden, sometimes an unbearable one. The conversation the next morning can be even worse. As Justin hit his late 20s, he had plenty of friends and enough money to afford a one-bedroom apartment downtown if he cut out some other expenses and gave up any hope of accumulating savings. The choice was easy. He decided to live alone. The experience was transformative. Now I can't imagine living with a roommate, Justin explains. I would not be happy. He's older, and in his social circle, he says, once you're past your mid-20s, there's an expectation that you'll either live with a partner or have a place of your own. There's a stigma around having roommates as a grown-up, he reports. I might be embarrassed to admit it. I mean, I feel like an adult now, and it's hard to imagine. Having roommates feels sort of unadult. 2. The capacity to live alone. I have always lived single and never yearned to live any other way, writes Bella DiPaolo, the psychologist, author, and singles advocate. DiPaolo grew up in Dunmore, Pennsylvania, a small town where children learned that getting married was all but obligatory. Before she went to college, it never occurred to her that she could opt out. But as an adult, she recognized that this was exactly what she wanted. I don't think there was a specific moment when I realized, I like living single. This is who I am. It's not going to change, she explains. To get to that point, I think I had to understand a bigger point. It is fine, good even, to live the life that is most meaningful to you, even if your way is not the most conventional one. One need not grow up in a small town like Dunmore to have trouble imagining the possibility of living alone someday. The ideal of achieving security in a marriage or with an intimate partner remains fundamental to our culture, and it is instilled in the minds of our young. Children in modern societies may well have more private space than they did in previous eras, but they are still raised in homes where there is at least one adult and often other children, too. Our early experiences living with others shape our expectations, establishing the shared household as a norm, if not an ideal. They also form our characters, leading us to develop skills, techniques, and models for sharing domestic space that we carry into adulthood, consciously or not. Hardly anyone lives alone until they are grown up, however, which means that those who go solo quickly discover that doing it well requires a lot of learning. Thoreau, Siddhartha, or Helen Gurley Brown may be inspiring, but there is no guidebook for domestic autonomy, at least not the contemporary kind. Living alone is challenging, no matter how excited one is to do so, not only because it entails facing oneself in an intimate setting, but also because it puts people in novel situations and generates a distinctive set of personal needs. Some of these challenges are pragmatic. Learning to shop and cook for one, balancing solitude and social life, establishing a healthy relationship with communications media, from the relatively passive consumption of television entertainment to more active engagements through the telephone and internet. Other challenges are more profound. Dealing with loneliness. Confronting fear that living alone is a sign of social failure. Being discriminated against in the housing market and the workplace. Relating to friends or family who are uncomfortable that someone close to them is unmarried, or who presume that this makes them unhappy, too. Although each person who develops the capacity to live alone finds it an intensely personal experience, my interviews suggest that some elements are widely shared. Today, young singletons actively reframe living alone as a mark of distinction and success, not social failure. They use it as a way to invest time in their personal and, above all, professional growth. Such investments in the self are necessary, they say, because contemporary families are fragile, as are most jobs, and in the end, each of us must be able to depend on ourselves. On the one hand, strengthening the self means undertaking solitary projects, acquiring domestic skills, learning to enjoy one's own company, and establishing confidence that one can set off for adventures on one's own. But on the other, it means making great efforts to be social, building up a strong network of friends and work contacts, and even, as the journalist Ethan Waters argues, forming urban tribes that substitute for families by providing community and support. Anchoring oneself in work and a tribe can help make going solo a rewarding experience, but it's rarely an enduring one. Most people who live alone into their 30s eventually find that their community weakens as close friends get married and have children, and that work, however rewarding, cannot satisfy their deepest needs. This puts them in a predicament. Those who have learned to enjoy their age of independence must choose between trying to reproduce it and seeking out a partner and a family. For men, this choice is rarely urgent, but for women it's a different matter, because living alone as they enter their late 30s means spending their nights beside a biological clock that keeps ticking, and they must confront the possibility that they'll never give birth to a child of their own. It's this situation that's prompted writers like Lori Gottlieb to argue that single women should settle on not quite desirable partners. But the argument is hardly persuasive. Marriage is hard enough when both parties enter it enthusiastically. Young adults who have learned to live alone doubt that marriage would be easier when it's a compromise from the start. They are open to discovering the right partner, but if they can't, they think they're better off in a place of their own. Most young adults who live alone see it as a stage, not an end point, and those who try it are usually excited for the challenge. Whether or not they are actively searching for a partner, they expect to find one and eventually to get married. Today, 84% of American women have been married by the time they reach age 40, and 95% have been married by the time they reach 65. True, the generations born in, say, 1945 and 1970 have profoundly different views on marriage, just not on the question of whether they will have one. Contemporary Americans may be skeptical of the institution, but about 90% of those who have never been married believe that someday they will. The major difference between marriage for those who are now 65 and those who are 25 is not whether to do it, but when. On average, American men and women born in the 1940s got married at ages 23 and 21, respectively, and by the time they'd reached their 40s, fewer than 6% had never wed. Today, the median age of first marriage is higher than it has been at any point since the census began recording it, 28 for men and 26 for women. In Massachusetts, New York, and Washington, D.C., the median age of first marriage is now over 30, just as it is in European nations such as Sweden and Denmark. In addition, an unprecedented number of Americans in their 40s have never married, 16% of men and 12% of women. They have plenty of time to live alone. How do they use that time? In Against Love, Laura Kipnis argues that avoiding binding relationships will free people for more play. She even suggests, provocatively, that such liberation could threaten the status quo. Free people might pose social dangers, she writes. Who knows what mischief they'd get up to? What other demands would come next? Alas, in the interviews conducted for this book, the most ambitious of those who live alone offered a clear and far less barricade-scaling answer. They are spending their free time at work. In modern economies, most of us are free agents, competing against one another for good jobs. In this environment, it's hard to know what free time really means. Today's workers, particularly the younger ones, are well aware that there is no longer a social contract between capital and labor. Instead, each of us works more and more in hope of getting established on our own, especially during the early part of our careers. For a rising generation of aspiring professionals, the 20s and early 30s is precisely not the time to get married and have a family. Rather, it is the life stage when we can pour ourselves into school or work and make an impression. We surrender control of our time to those who educate and employ us, and what remains we give to the task of improving ourselves. We learn new skills, demonstrate our versatility, travel, relocate, build a network, develop a reputation, climb the ladder, go on the market and find something better, do it all over again. All of this is easier when you're not accountable to anyone, and especially when you live alone. There is a price for prosperity in the contemporary economy. The work world makes extraordinary claims on the lives of young workers. Give yourself to business during the prime of your life, or give up your hope of achieving any real success. This is true in for-profit corporations, but also in seemingly less exploitative workplaces, including universities and non-profit organizations that are dedicated to improving our quality of life. When I was in graduate school at Berkeley, for instance, I knew several students in their late 20s whose advisor, a pioneering female scholar, actively discouraged them from entering serious relationships before they had made their mark. "Academia has become extraordinarily competitive," she argued. "Tenure-track jobs are disappearing everywhere, and teaching jobs that pay the bills are scarce. Relationships are demanding and distracting. They can slow you down, or worse, compromise the quality of your work. What's more, few of them last. Don't you owe it to yourself to prioritize work?" The so-called creative class of those who work in the knowledge economies share a similar ethos. True, the lucky ones can occasionally enjoy a ping-pong game or free food in the office, but they also face enormous demands on their time and energy. They are not only vying for market share in fiercely competitive industries, from software to cinema, advertising to art, they are also trying to break down the barriers between their personal and professional lives, making work the primary site for what Matthew Crawford calls soul craft, and often for their social time, too. In Free Agent Nation, the business writer Daniel Pink reports that self-employed entrepreneurs in a wide variety of fields also experience work as completely consuming. Pink calls the tens of millions of Americans who exist this way soloists because their prospects depend mostly on their own individual efforts rather than on the benevolence of a large institution. This change in the nature of work can be liberating, terrifying, exhausting, and exhilarating. As one of his sources puts it, "The worst part about going out on your own is that you have to work 24 hours a day. The best part is that you get to choose which 24. There's less choice in fields such as banking, law, media, or medicine, where managers need not advise anyone to put themselves, or really their work, before their relationships, because the job implicitly requires it. In these and other high-power, high-paying professions, some employers demand that young workers spend most of their waking hours, 70, 80, 90 per week, in the office or traveling on business, or checking in from a BlackBerry if they stray into personal time. Today, young professionals routinely cancel lunch dates, evening plans, even entire vacations because something's come up at work. Take Mark, an investment banker who, when in his mid-20s, never showed up to the apartment he'd rented with his girlfriend on the West Coast, even after she'd moved into it, because his job suddenly required him to stay back east. Needless to say, their relationship soon ended, and eventually he began to plan his life around the realities of his vocation. I would still date, he tells me, but I sought out much younger women who are not interested in the answer to the dreaded five-word question, where is this relationship going? I wanted to be open to meeting the right woman, but I was also avoiding it because I prioritized my career and spent my social time with coworkers. I thought I'd have time for marriage and kids later on. Mark is not the only one who has adapted to the 24/7 work culture by making the office the hub of his social life. One attorney we interviewed says that after 2 years of 70-hour work weeks, his gay colleagues had become his primary peer group. And Justin, the journalist we met in Chapter 1, says that he doesn't mind the long hours because it's a social environment, you know? I'm surrounded by a lot of people with similar interests. I do a lot of interacting, talking, email, bopping down the hall to discuss a story or just shoot the shit. He, too, reports that his friends from work are now his most common companions outside the office. We go out to lunch together, and we have sports teams from outside of work, a tennis team, a softball team. It's fun. The office is not the only place where the lines between the personal and professional lives of young adults have blurred. Now that smartphones are standard accessories in their cultural universe, and expansive social networks on sites such as Facebook generate constant chatter among friends from every sphere of life, the worlds of work and play swirl together in a steady stream of messages that they follow wherever they are. One woman we interviewed, an attorney in her early 30s who works in politics, tells me, "Of my 9-hour day, I'm spending 7 hours responding to emails, mostly job-related, but many from friends and family, too. I also have like 350 people in my cell phone," she explains. "It buzzes often. She checks it constantly, and she always tries to respond quickly, even if she's out with friends and the call or message is from work. This behavior is not unusual. Although we often associate living alone with social isolation, for most adults, the reverse is true. In many cases, those who live alone are socially overextended, and hyperactive use of digital media keeps them even busier. The young urban professionals we interviewed report that they struggle more with avoiding the distraction of always available social activity from evenings with friends to online chatter than with being disconnected. Singles in the U.S., the new nuclear family, confirms this. The large-scale study by the market research firm Packaged Facts reports that those who live alone are more likely than others to say that the internet has changed the way they spend their free time, more likely to be online late at night, and more likely to say that using the net has cut into their sleep. Not that they are homebodies. According to a Pew Foundation study of social isolation and new technology, heavy users of the internet and social media are actually more likely than others to have large and diverse social networks, visit public places where strangers may interact, and participate in volunteer organizations. Singles and people who live alone are twice as likely as married people to go to bars and dance clubs. They eat out in restaurants more often, are more likely to take art or music classes, attend public events, and go shopping with friends. To be sure, many occasionally struggle with loneliness or with the feeling that they need to change something to make their lives feel more complete. But so too do their married friends and family members and, really, most everyone during some periods of their lives. Finding a partner or a live-in companion is not enough to solve the social pain of loneliness, which is a fundamental part of the human experience. As they hit their middle and late 30s, however, many singles who live alone begin to question why they haven't coupled up yet, and whether they would be happier if they did. It's not easy to answer. Mark, for instance, says that staying single through his 30s allowed him to experience things that his friends who married and had children could only dream about. Living in different countries, taking adventurous vacations, dating lots of women and figuring out what kind of partner he wants. He's also certain that he's benefited from spending so much time and effort building a professional network early in his career, because he needed it to find a new job during the recent financial crisis. As he approached 40, Mark began to believe he had missed out on something important. "I look at my friends who are married and have these adorable young children, and I worry that I made a mistake. My life feels pretty empty sometimes, and I'd like to be part of something more meaningful than what I do at work. I'd actually like to marry the woman I'm dating now, but she may not be interested in starting a family with someone who's spent the past several years doing the kinds of things I've been doing." Women, he knows, can be suspicious of never-married men in their late 30s and 40s. "I need to convince her that I can cut down on the endless work hours and give up the big nights drinking at nightclubs full of single women. I feel like I'm done with that." She's not sure. Of course, as a successful man in a city crowded with single women, Mark enjoys certain luxuries that women his age do not. Most important, he's in no hurry to answer the question of whether he wants to become a biological parent, and he believes that if things don't work out with his current girlfriend, he can search for another without worrying that his reproductive capacities will have diminished. Although some women may be suspicious of long-term bachelors, Mark has no fears about becoming stigmatized. Gentle ribbing from his mother, who's long past ready for grandchildren, and occasional jealous confessions from married friends who fantasize about being single in New York City are the main ways that his single status comes up. Women who live alone in their 30s and 40s face far more social pressure. Whether single by choice or by chance, most of the women we interviewed report that, after their 20s, concerns about whether and how to find a partner and have children became an inescapable part of their lives. They notice that certain people, friends, family, even recent acquaintances, are always calling attention to their domestic status. These are the ones who, in nearly every conversation, quickly ask whether they are dating anyone or start suggesting eligible bachelors and treat everything else as secondary. This experience is common among women who go solo, so much so that many question whether it's really about them or the projected anxieties of their acquaintances. But nearly all report that it makes them feel stigmatized. Regardless of their personal or professional accomplishments, they see their public identity as spoiled, as the sociologist Irving Goffman put it, reduced from something big and complex and interesting to that of the single woman alone. Questions about dating are hardly the only source of stigma for young women who live alone. Television programs and magazine stories regularly trot out psychologists with advice on how to make yourself more attractive and find a partner, or sociologists who warn about how much you will suffer if you don't. For instance, Linda Waite and Maggie Gallagher, authors of The Case for Marriage, "Science tends to confirm grandma's wisdom. On the whole, man was not meant to live alone, and neither was woman." Politicians across the spectrum decry the decline of marriage and the culture of selfish singles. Doctors warn their female patients about the risks of delaying childbirth until they reach advanced maternal age. Anti-single messages even come from within, since it's hard not to internalize a lifetime's worth of messages about the importance of coupling up or having children, not to mention the horrors of spinsterhood. Women who live alone are all too aware that delaying marriage means reducing the odds of having a biological child. They may not have read the recent study showing that, in the 1970s, only 1 in 10 American women ended her childbearing years, at age 45, though for most women it is younger, without giving birth, whereas 1 in 5 women do so today. But since they know many other women in their situation, they wouldn't be surprised by the trend. If living alone and being childless in one's late 30s and early 40s has become more common, it hasn't gotten any easier. Even the most confident and successful solo women we interviewed openly questioned whether they had made the right choices for themselves. Molly, a web designer in her late 30s, defines herself as a fierce individualist. "I've always liked to have a lot of alone time," she explains, her soft brown eyes seeking out understanding and her mouth slightly open, making her appear somewhat vulnerable or exposed. "I'm not someone who intertwines that well." She and her sister grew up as latchkey kids with divorced parents, both of whom used Molly as their mediator. "I wasn't just the caretaker. I was also like the rodeo clown. Everybody always put their stuff on me and I had to run interference. When I went off to college, I was so excited. I felt like enormous amounts of weight were lifted off of me. I didn't call home for months." Molly moved to Boston after graduation and rented a place with roommates. She went out a lot and had a few relationships, but nothing serious. After 6 years, she moved to New York City, and when she could afford it, got a place of her own in Kips Bay. Now Molly's 37, and she doesn't think she's incomplete without a partner, even when she's home alone. "I really love being able to create that little vacuum of space for myself," she says. "I don't even feel desolate. Sometimes I don't even answer the phone if it rings. It's not like I don't have good interpersonal relationships, but I think that sometimes they can be too close, and to have that with someone and also be living together, there's just like no relief, no time when it's just me by myself, not having to think about anybody else and whatever. It's just too close for comfort for me." Despite herself, when she was in her 20s and early 30s, Molly thought she might enjoy moving in with a partner or getting married. "I did enormous amounts of dating," she says. "I was looking for the guy." A few of her relationships lasted a year, at which point she would ask herself, "Do I want to go the distance with this person?" And I just always opted against it. By the time she turned 35, Molly had tired of trying. She was working long hours, and using her hard-won free time to meet men felt wasteful, even self-destructive. She started spending more time hanging out with friends, mostly co-workers and people she'd met on snowboarding trips. "I just like that I don't have to worry about anybody else's anything," she explains. This has made her happier than dating, and so she has decided to stop searching for a man. Yet not even Molly can escape worrying that she's making a bad decision, or, worse, that her satisfaction living alone reflects a personal failure. Usually she feels fortunate to live at a moment when going solo is a viable option. "Living alone is just something that I like so much," she says. "If I were living in a different time, when you went from your father's house to your husband's house, I wonder if I would have learned as much about myself." But at low points, it's different. "I just kind of wonder, like, is there something wrong with me that I'm not with somebody? Was there something that happened many years ago that's still sort of echoing into my whole life?" No matter how much she enjoys going solo or how well it suits her, it takes extraordinary strength to feel good about being on her own, Molly explains. When you live alone as a woman, confidence is something you have to build. Ella, a public interest lawyer in her mid-30s, is brazen and brilliant, with long blonde hair, big blue eyes, and muscular arms. She is also particularly attuned to the challenges of learning to live alone as a woman, and her efforts to overcome them are worth exploring at length. "I see so many women of my age around me who are feeling desperation," she explains. "Like, I can't be alone. There's something wrong with me if I'm alone." "I don't feel that at all. I've had friends over the last 4 or 5 years, women who were hysterical about finding a man. They were lonely and they didn't know how to be in the world alone. I really don't ever want to become that way." She gets upset when she hears people urge women her age to marry undesirable partners. Ella believes that most women would be better off holding out until they find what they are looking for, and if not, learning how to live alone. After all, by the time she had reached her mid-30s, she had already seen several friends endure the trauma of divorce or separation, and she's skeptical that those who take the advice to settle would avoid this fate. Perhaps Ella would view things differently if it was clear that marriage generated tangible benefits for someone in her situation. But she doesn't think that the studies documenting the benefits of marriage have much relevance to her case. Ella is a voracious reader, and she knows that men get the lion's share of the marriage dividend, especially now that a growing number of women are not just outliving, but also out-earning their spouses. She's also seen research showing that married women are actually more likely than singles to suffer from depression, and that as they get invested in domesticity, they become less likely to sustain their large social networks or advance in their careers. At this point, her family, close friends, and work projects are her greatest sources of meaning. The challenge, as she sees it, is to make the most of them and to learn how to enjoy both the solitude and the companionship that her lifestyle affords. Ella has done this deliberately. Soon after she settled into her current job, she purchased a cozy one-bedroom apartment in Brooklyn Heights, where there's vibrant street life, a wide range of services, and a lot of other singles her age. She became a regular at a local yoga studio, where she not only learned how to focus her mental energy and feel more at ease with herself, but also developed a new set of friends. "I've been going there for about 4 years now, so I know everybody," Ella explains. "It's a really tight-knit community, not competitive or weird." Although she had always seen herself as an outsider, not a joiner, after a few years in the neighborhood, she discovered that she had become ensconced there, and she liked it. "A really nice thing about living in New York is that it's so anonymous," Ella says, "but it's nice to create your niche, especially when you're living alone. And I really love having lived in one place long enough to walk around and run into people I know every day." Ella also likes staying home on occasion and not seeing people. With work and her busy social life to manage, sometimes it feels better to keep to herself. "I'm almost too content on my own," she acknowledges. But getting this way took some effort. Though Ella has always liked cooking, at first it wasn't easy to do without company. The elaborate process of planning, shopping, preparing, cooking, and eating felt strange and wasteful when she did it all solo. She didn't exactly long for the idealized family dinner, but she was all too aware that many of her contemporaries view dining alone, whether at home or in public, as a sign of social failure or just plain sad. Moreover, Ella shared the sentiment that some naysaying singles conveyed to the food writer and editor Judith Jones. "I like to cook for others, to give my friends pleasure. Why would I want to go to all that trouble just for me?" Gradually, however, Ella recognized that cooking for one required cultivating a special talent, the will and capacity to use her time, money, and creative energy to fulfill her own needs. It was a challenge worth pursuing, because the skill, as those who have mastered it attest, transcends the kitchen. Fundamentally, it is about learning to take care of yourself. Knowing how to enjoy going solo outside the home is just as important as living well inside of it. Yet young adults who live alone often struggle to take pleasure in certain mundane, everyday activities, going to a restaurant, bar, concert, or movie, for example, because they grew up believing that these are things one shouldn't do alone. For many, traveling alone is particularly daunting. Single women are often warned about the dangers of going on the road without a companion. Even travel writing that encourages women to do so can easily convey the opposite message. The article, "A Woman Traveling Alone? The World Can Be Your Oyster Too," which appeared in the Boston Globe in 2009, notes that traveling alone can be quite a social experience. Yet it also warns, safety is the top concern for female travelers, and quotes the author of a book for female travelers who says, "The moment we step out of the door, we are aware of the footsteps behind us." The article's advice? Consider taking a women's self-defense course and learn how to decrease your chances of being a victim. This is sage, no doubt, but not exactly emboldening. Ella, who lived abroad as a student and now travels regularly for work, has turned herself into an intrepid traveler. She takes adventurous treks and ambitious group tours to remote countries, as well as silent, week-long yoga retreats outside the city, because her apartment does not offer a sufficient escape from the stress of urban life. Like most singles, Ella perceives that the travel industry is designed for couples. Hotel rooms and car rentals, for instance, typically cost the same for one person as for two, and advertising usually targets couples and families. In recent years, however, she has noticed that the market is beginning to accommodate the emerging demands of independent tourists. According to the Travel Industry Association, singles and solo dwellers account for 27% of the domestic tourism market, and about 10% of leisure travelers go alone. Recently, a number of hotels, spas, and cruise lines have taken notice. In February 2010, for instance, Norwegian Cruise Line announced that it would install 128 studios for solo travelers on its Caribbean tours. These guests would pay the same per-person rate as members of couples, a major change from standard industry practice, which demands that single travelers pay for two. Yet travel, no matter how welcoming the accommodations, is ultimately just a temporary escape from the challenge of crafting a meaningful life alone. And as veteran adventure seekers like Ella acknowledge, if you're not thoughtful about how you do it, the search for the new can get old. I've heard so many people say that they love living alone because it allows them to travel whenever and wherever they want, the journalist Ethan Waters told me. But traveling turns out to be a false god. It can't answer your deepest questions or deliver you much more than an extended break. Eventually, all solo tourists learn that home is their final destination, and that's where they have to make their lives work. Discrimination from employers, real estate agents, and housing associations makes arranging one's everyday life more complicated, and the people we interviewed report that learning to fight it is essential for living alone. For instance, singles report that their supervisors and colleagues respect the personal time of employees with spouses and children, but not theirs. "In my office, I'm the only one living alone," Ella explains. "They all work long hours, but when there's something urgent, something that might take a while to complete, Ella often gets the call because everyone knows she has no companion or children whose needs demand attention and may get in the way." This is a common complaint. Molly, the web designer, says that in her office, single people are expected to work more, harder. "If you have this claim of a child at home, it's understood that you're going to leave earlier than other people. It's understood that, of course, you can't work on the weekend." Sherry Langbert, an entrepreneur in her late 30s, started a website that offers products, advice, and community building for singles and singletons after experiencing discrimination firsthand. She's thin and fashionable, with a heart-shaped face, long brown hair, and an edgy, slightly nervous disposition. She's concerned about the ways in which unspoken prejudices shape people's personal and professional experiences. "And when I first meet her, she complains that differential treatment in the workplace runs deeper than most people think. When I worked in corporate America, I was in a situation where everyone in my office got pregnant around the same time. So I'm coming in at 8, and they're coming in at 10:30, and then they're going to doctor's appointments at 2. And I get it. But there's no balance. I mean, they're leaving at 5 once they have the kids because they need to get home. That's fine, but then I'm sitting there working until 7. There was just a very big difference in the workloads.
What really irked her, however, was the time she was denied a bonus that her married colleagues in an underperforming division received. When she complained, her boss, who was friendly but always treated her as if she were some kind of party girl, told her that the managers believed that, as a single woman who dressed well and appeared to have an active social life, she was doing fine as is.
People make assumptions. He said, "You wear all these clothes and you're always out, and we figured you don't need it."
Sherry left the job soon after to start singleedition.com, and one of the website's most popular features is a forum in which participants discuss how to handle discrimination in the workplace. Another popular feature is a forum for singles to discuss discrimination in the real estate market. This is a particular problem in cities with a lot of cooperative apartments, because in these buildings, prospective buyers have to be approved by private boards whose members may not believe that those living a singles lifestyle make appropriate neighbors. Sherry experienced this personally when she moved to New York City and started working with a real estate agent. She found several co-op apartments appealing, yet the agent steered her away from them.
"You're a woman, you're single, and you're Canadian," he told her. "No board is ever going to approve you." He kept saying that. "But I had this great job. I had money in the bank." And this guy was like, "No."
Exasperated, Sherry decided to switch brokers. "Everyone was sending me names for the best broker in the city, and they would all just say the same thing. You clearly have the financial backing and the secure job, but you're single. You're a woman and you're from Canada. 3 strikes. You're going to get rejected."
It kept happening over and over. It was ridiculous. I was 32 years old, and I'd call my friends crying.
Eventually, Sherry stopped trying and didn't start again until she got married.
"With my husband," she says, "it was easy peasy."
Those who do not need approval from co-op boards have an easier time finding a home. In fact, the spike in housing purchases by singles is one of the most remarkable changes related to the fast rise of living alone. This was also inspired by an important legal reform. The Equal Credit Opportunity Act, which Congress passed in 1975, prohibited lenders from rejecting applicants on the basis of sex or marital status and from asking women what kind of birth control they used or whether they planned to have children. Singles, particularly women, were suddenly able to enter the housing market. According to the National Association of Realtors, in 1981, single women represented 10% of all U.S. home buyers. At the time, this practice was so novel that the New York Times reported, "Invariably, when single women talk about having purchased a home, the sentiment expressed is, 'I never would have considered this 10 years ago.'" By 2009, single men and women accounted for 10 and 21% of all home buyers, respectively, and together they represented nearly one-third of the market. Single men and women also made up 12 and 24% of first-time home buyers, respectively, or more than one-third of the market. In the 1950s, real estate agents would have been surprised to see a single female client in their office. Now it's surprising if they don't. "I've been in realty for about 15 years now, and the trend has increased throughout the years," the president of the Chicago Association of Realtors told a local newspaper. "It's not a trend. It's a norm." The increase in home buying by single women under age 45 is especially striking. From an economic perspective, the cause of the change looks obvious. Today, more women have received advanced education and established themselves in successful careers than ever before. In 1970, for instance, 36% of all college graduates were women, compared to 54% today. Women's income still lags behind men's, and there's not yet equal pay for equal work, but the pay gap is narrowing. In the 1970s, the median income of full-time female workers was about 52% of what full-time male workers earned. By 2007, it was up to 71%. Single women have made even greater gains, particularly compared to single men. According to the Pew Research Center, among U.S.-born unmarried adults ages 30 to 44 at every level of education, women's median household incomes rose more than men's from 1970 to 2007, and unmarried women in 2007 had higher household incomes than their 1970 counterparts at each level of education. Single women's relative economic success is only part of the reason that they have become the fastest growing participants in the housing market. After all, on average, single men continue to earn more than single women, yet they are much less likely to purchase places of their own. My interviews suggest that the spike in women's home buying is due not only to their economic success, but also to dramatic changes in the social psychology of living alone. Whereas not long ago most women viewed getting married as the key moment in the transition to adulthood, today there are other ways to make the change. Men who live alone in their 30s and 40s show little interest in committing to a home or a neighborhood, and they rarely feel the need to settle down. But for a growing number of single women in early adulthood, buying a home has become a powerful way to pivot from one life stage into another. It's a signal to themselves and to those who know them that they are ready to invest in themselves. Kimberly lives in New York City and works in the film industry. Her shoulder-length brown hair frames a pale complexion and a sweet but somewhat sinister smile that conveys her confident and mischievous side. She's enjoyed great success in a competitive field, but she admits that she experienced an emotional crash when she found herself alone in her early 30s. It took several years to address the pain related to her own unmet expectations. "I was sad and depressed and lonely," she recounts. "It wasn't really where I wanted to be." But work kept her busy, and that helped her avoid despair. "I could ignore it during the week because I had somewhere to be all day and into the night. But those weekends got hard. Like, you know, you wake up on a Sunday and you just have nothing. You plan nothing and you're on your own." Kimberly